John. There. Here we go.
All natural, commercial. Simply fruit punch, tropical, and mixed berry juice.
Oh, well, y'all, you got your commercial.
Some of us say they're simply refreshing.
Too bad, y'all.
Others prefer refreshingly simple. And that's about as complicated as it gets.
The Halusa Nation. The human beings. The people. See the spiritual in the natural, through sense and feeling. Everything is related. All the things of earth and in the sky have spirit. Everything is sacred. Confronted by the alien nation, the subjects and the citizens see the material religions through trauma and numb. Nothing is related. All the things of the earth and in the sky have energy to be exploited. Even themselves, mining their spirits into souls sold. Into nothing is sacred, not even their self. The Ally Nation, Alien Nation.
All right, welcome to the pledge drive. We rehearsed last week and didn't get any pledges, so maybe you guys knew. My name's Paul Muth. I'm in with the show Window on the World. Dave Johnson. Window on the World is what I'll be doing tomorrow. That's right. This is News from Neptune, the radio edition. Lots of stuff going on, including flash floods. There was one in my car, but that's only because I forgot myself and didn't close the window. So I hope... I guess there are four tornadoes sighted in the area as well, and there was no damage except to some farm buildings, some poles and stuff. Thank you very much. I've got a show that includes the regular feature with Greg Palast, the election protection. He's actually talking mainly about the debut of his film, which screened last night, I guess it was, or was it the night before, in Oakland. You can go to gregpalast.com to find out who's arranging screenings. It'd be great to have one here. He's been covering the beat of voter suppression and election theft since before 2000, but his expose on 2000 didn't get any traction in the U.S. media, though it was on the BBC that he was working on at the time. I'll kick it off with my usual features. I'm going to play a 10-minute excerpt from John Kay Wilson, who was at the Friday Forum yesterday. We'll have that on the air this coming Monday. Look for possible changes in this schedule as far as where the Friday Forum will be represented. Just talking to Eunice about the pipeline suspension of all activity is the way I understood it. Amy Goodman has a short print paragraph that seems to be a concise update. There's a lot of focus on it, and I think it's... important because it ties together a lot of things. The poverty of our petroleum-based economic system, I guess we'll call it. The plight of the suppressed minority of the indigenous, which anybody who's watching it closely here In the grand state of Illinois, where the Indian Removal Act was fairly effective. Actually, there was a enclave of Kennecook in Danville area that stayed on by not highlighting their difference to some extent, but they were eventually removed as well. But talking about trying to point to the Salida case and the absolute, it's beyond decimation. There is no Native American studies unit with any faculty right now. There is a Native American house and they're doing activities, but there's no instruction in the indigenous peoples of this country. And it's largely, I think, because of the attempt to tie it into the global structure of the way European culture has dominated and colonized indigenous cultures around the world. An important issue, which hopefully will be addressed at the academic level sometime soon. Write your academy, I guess. There are people working on it now. All right, kicking it off with the usual feature from Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report. I haven't actually screened this, so I'll be listening closely as well. Maybe people ought to be claiming they're voting for HRC, even if they don't intend to change the polls to, well, listen to what Glenn Ford says. The Pride parade is happening this weekend, if it doesn't get rained out. Hopefully it'll be clement through the afternoon. Durbin will be the marshal, Senator Durbin, of the parade, and there's some local activity to highlight the Saudi arms deal. And it's entirely appropriate. The misogynist Saudi fiefdoms, it's not really a nation state, it's kingdoms, it's feudal, is reprehensible in a lot of ways. The current, how does Medea Benjamin put it? The kingdom of the unjust, which is a reversal of the meaning, I guess. Should be demonstrated against, and this is a perfectly good venue, and there's a call to do that, and I'll try to get some details on that fairly straight away. But here's Glenn Ford's kind of odd twist on electoral politics.
On Tuesday night, just as I was preparing to do a commentary on whether Donald Trump might threaten to drop out of the televised debates if the candidates for the Green and Libertarian parties weren't allowed to participate, I ran across a story that claimed Trump had already done just that. A website called the Santa Monica Observer reported the Trump decision as fact, but without naming a source. Nobody else ran the story, and the Trump campaign said it wasn't true, so it was probably a hoax. However, a Trump threat to boycott the debates remains a tantalizing prospect, given that back in 2000 he said it was disgraceful that the Democrats and Republicans were able to shut the smaller parties out of the presidential debates. Green Party campaign senior advisor Kevin Zeese has all but dared Trump to live up to his principled stance of 16 years ago. Principles aside, Trump has some self-centered reasons to want Jill Stein and Gary Johnson standing next to him and Hillary on September 26th. Very few Green Party supporters would vote for Trump under any circumstances, so a good showing by Stein doesn't come at his expense. But, according to recent polls, voters that now plan to pull the lever for Gary Johnson's Libertarian campaign would otherwise be split about evenly between Trump and Clinton. Therefore, Trump would appear to have a relative net advantage over Clinton if there were a vigorous four-way presidential contest. I personally don't think that such mathematical calculations are central to the way Donald Trump thinks. He really is a narcissist who always talks about winning and can't stand to lose. And unless that comb-over has affected his brain cells, he should know that Clinton is even better at lying on her feet than he is. She studies her lies, while Trump just makes things up as he goes along. If Trump becomes convinced that he is going to lose this election badly or be humiliated in the debates, he will seek to muddy the waters by introducing other actors into the contest so that Clinton can't say that she beat him one-on-one. That is, he'll do the right thing and call for Stein and Johnson's participation in the debates, but only in order to protect his own fragile ego. Right now, some polls are showing Trump even with Clinton, which is probably bad news for Stein and Johnson's chances of getting in the first debate, but that could change quickly. There's little hope that Stein and Johnson will average 15% in the polls, the arbitrary cutoff the Republicans and Democrats have imposed to keep third parties out. That's because the media corporations that both commission the polls and monopolize the news dedicate only 0.5% of their election coverage to the Green and Libertarian parties. As a result, about 1/3 of the public has never even heard of Jill Stein or Gary Johnson. This is what elections have come to in an age when monopoly capital has a monopoly on information and defines what is and isn't news and who is and isn't worthy of public office. Both Trump and Clinton are products of this dictatorship of capital. It's a crime that Jill Stein and Gary Johnson won't be seen by the debate's huge audience unless Donald Trump is convinced he can't win. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Number down here is 359-9338. It's been quite a morning. I don't know how you're waking up. I haven't pulled up the information about this demo. I guess it would be from wherever the parade marshal starts the Pride Parade this afternoon. There's a map you can find online, and I'll see if I can convey it to you at some point. If you want to chime in on the Saudi arms deal, beyond historic amount of armament sold to the Saudis, and cluster bombs are included, even though they now claim they're not making any more. I guess they built up enough of a reservoir they can still sell cluster bombs. They're claim that they have non-personnel uses like sabotaging airstrips and stuff. I'm going to play Mumi Abu-Jamal. He's not really talking about the prison uprising or the strike that happened. This is happening right now and should get more coverage than it is, it seems, in the regular press. He's mainly talking about the campaign that he's in with some others to get medical aid to prisoners, another abomination of the incarceration state that we're in. Amy Goodman's got something on the Standing Rock demo. It was great to see that she made it out there for the day and got some of that footage that you've seen. And even some of the major media must have made arrangements to buy it. I guess Telesur maybe had a cameraman there as well, or there were some other independent cameramen. So I did see some different angles on the atrocities happening there. Does an update about this blockage of all construction, which I'm going to try and suss out. People here didn't know that that's what happened. It came out late last night, and after the court rejected the injunction, the Army, Department of Justice, and Department of Interior said it will not issue permits for the Dakota Access to drill under the Missouri River until they reassess and reconsider. All right, let's sort that out in a bit. But here's Mumia talking about his special case, but it should be seen in the whole context of the, like I say, the incarceration state and the fact that half of incarcerees apparently do work of some kind or another, and there's a strike now.
My friends, my brothers, my sisters, I thank you for joining us today. We're here about a medical injustice. Recently, the court, in our case against the DOC and medical treatment, found that the DOC and the company that they contract to provide medical services were not doing what is needed, that is treating patients. And, in the words of the judge, they use deliberate indifference to people's medical needs. And they did so, he said, based upon fiscal, not medical concerns. We took one step. We are moving forward. But this is not just about myself. There are over 6,000, according to the DOC's numbers, men and women who are infected with hepatitis C and are not being treated. Under the DOC's so-called protocol, which was revealed in our hearing here in Scranton, the DOC essentially let people almost die. They had to be bleeding from their esophagus to be considered for treatment. That was deliberate indifference to medical needs. It created needless suffering, and it is unconstitutional. So we're building a movement, and we need to be moving, and we need to remember the words of our beloved, honorable ancestor, Frederick Douglass, who said, power concedes nothing without demand. We've got to demand this fair and better treatment for thousands of men and women who are held captive in the DOC. I thank you for what you have done. Let us move forward. On the move, long live John Africa, let us win. From Imprisoned Nation, this is your brother, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And I always think of the people that are saying, why is he playing that cop killer? And he didn't get a fair trial, that's pretty clear. And I'm convinced that the storyline that I've heard through the years that some bad cops in Philly, and they did get caught a few years later, managed to eliminate two of their opponents at the same time. Faulkner apparently was going to testify against some of the corruption he saw in the police force. And Mumia Abu-Jamal, in his capacity as independent journalist and a stringer for NPR station WHYY, actually was covering the beat as well of police corruption because it was so ubiquitous in Philly at the time. Not that to say that it isn't now, but that's my theory of the case. And it's clear that he had a racist judge who should have not been wearing the robes at all. So I will update this commentary from Amy Goodman because it was filed before the last night's. Was characterized as an Obama, but it was a combination of the Justice Department, the Army Corps, and the Interior Department, would it have been? Let's see if I can find that again. But here's Amy's commentary reflecting on her week of coverage of the Standing Rock standoff. And the fact that they didn't want it drilled through near Bismarck, which was the original site of the crossing of the Missouri River until the very last minute, it's pretty clear that it, as usual, the environmental racism, the least powerful forces get the brunt of this degradation of the petrol industrial state, if you will. It's not an uncommon thing, it seems to me. Already 10:18, so I guess I'll be editing my storyboard on the fly. I probably won't get to the Gareth Porter from Redacted News. Have a shorter segment with Kevin Pena interviewing Greg Palast, but he does reprise some interesting parts of the story that he covers in this new, not quite a documentary, it's sort of a dramatization. I don't know if they still call them docudramas. It's apparently a different kind of turn of things and includes some Hollywood actors as well as individuals, voters who were wronged by the system to characterize and illustrate what's going on in the way of voter suppression through cross-check and all of the other rubbish that's going down. But here's Amy breaking the sound barrier.
Standoff at Standing Rock. Even attack dogs can't stop the Native American resistance. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The Missouri River, the longest river in North America, has for thousands of years provided the water necessary for life to the region's original inhabitants. To this day, millions of people rely on the Missouri for clean drinking water. Now a petroleum pipeline called the Dakota Access Pipeline is being built, threatening the river. A movement has grown to block the pipeline, led by Native American tribes that have lived along the banks of the Missouri from time immemorial. Members of the Dakota and Lakota nations from the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation established a camp at the confluence of the Missouri and Cannonball Rivers, about 50 miles south of Bismarck, North Dakota. They declare themselves protectors, not protesters. Last Saturday, as they attempted to face down massive bulldozers on their ancient burial sites, the pipeline security guards attacked the mostly Native American protectors with dogs and pepper spray as they resisted the $3.8 billion pipeline's construction, fighting for clean water, protection of sacred ground, and an end to our fossil fuel economy. Standing Rock Sioux set up the first resistance encampment in April, calling it Sacred Stone. Now there are four camps with more than 1,000 people, mostly from Native American tribes in the U.S. and Canada. Water is life is the mantra of this nonviolent struggle against the pipeline that's being built to carry crude oil from the Bakken oil fields of North Dakota to Illinois. Saturday was a beautiful sunny day. Together with Laura Gottesdiener and John Hamilton of Democracy Now!, we spent the morning filming interviews. That afternoon, delegations walked down the road to plant their tribal flags in the path of the proposed pipeline. Many were shocked to see large bulldozers actively carving up the land on Labor Day weekend. Hundreds of people, mainly Native Americans, lined the route, yelling for the destruction to stop. A group of women began shaking the ranch fencing, and without much effort, it fell over. The land defenders began pouring through. Several young men from the camp arrived on horseback. The bulldozers retreated, but the security guards attempted to repel the land defenders, unleashing at least half a dozen vicious dogs who bit both people and horses. One dog had blood dripping from its mouth and nose. Undeterred, the dog's handler continued to push the dog into the crowd. The guards pepper sprayed the protesters, punched and tackled them. Vicious dogs like mastiffs have been used to attack indigenous peoples in the Americas since the time of Christopher Columbus and the Spanish conquistadors who followed him. In the end, the violent Dakota Access guards were forced back. This section of the pipeline path contained archaeological sites, including Lakota-Dakota burial grounds. The tribe had supplied the locations of the sites in a court filing just the day before, seeking a temporary halt to construction to fully investigate them. With those locations in hand, the Dakota Access Pipeline crew literally plowed ahead. Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Chair David Archambault told us on the Democracy Now! NewsHour,
They were using the dogs as a deadly weapon. This was all premeditated. They knew something was going to happen when they leapfrogged over 15 miles of undisturbed land to destroy our sacred sites. They knew that something was going to happen, so they were prepared. They hired a company that had guard dogs, and then they came in, and they waited. And it was by the time we saw what was going on, it was too late. Everything was destroyed. The fact is that they desecrated our ancestral grave sites. They just destroyed prayer sites.
At the camp, we interviewed Winona LaDuke, an Ojibwe leader from the White Earth Nation in northern Minnesota. She recently led a campaign that succeeded in blocking another pipeline, the Sandpiper, that threatened the White Earth's territory. She commented on North Dakota Governor Jack Dalrymple's support of suppression of the Standing Rock protests.
You know, you are not George Wallace, and this is not Alabama. You know, this is 2016, and you don't get to treat Indians like you have for those last 100 years. We're done.
The battle against the Dakota Access Pipeline is being waged as a renewed assertion of indigenous rights and sovereignty, as a fight to protect clean water, but most importantly, as part of the global struggle to combat climate change and break from dependence on fossil fuels. At the Sacred Stone, Red Warrior, and other camps at the confluence of the Missouri and Cannonball Rivers, the protectors are there to stay, and their numbers are growing daily. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah, amazing coverage this week. And from the Democracy Now! Website on Web Exclusive, there's a short article with some links about what happened. The court proceeding will still be appealed, but apparently there has been a suspension of all the current permits. The Justice Department, Interior Department, and Army Corps of Engineers had a joint announcement. Will not issue permits for Dakota Actis to drill under the Missouri River. And near the Lake Ahe as well. Ohahe? I don't know how that's said. So it still needs to be sorted out whether how much has actually been suspended. And I was supposed to pull up the Pride thing and the Durban demo. It's at 2:30, and I've got in front of the old theater. The Children's Museum stuck under my head, but I actually don't think that's right. Let's see. A staging area. That's the Facebook page on the event. Urged Durban at CU Pride to oppose Sardi arms deal. Is an invitation from Robert Damon of Just Foreign Policy. Just says a CU Pride staging area. Now that's pretty huge, actually. But I guess go to where the signs are not rainbow colored and might have some other information. I'll try to fine tune that a little bit. Maybe just want to go wander around the staging area. That's what I do for the 4th of July parade. I don't rarely go to the parade these days. I just ride my bicycle through the staging area and see the floats as I move by them instead of vice versa. Here's something coming up this week, September 14th at the Virginia Theater. There's a screening of a film about gun safety. The film is called Under the Gun, Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America is the sponsoring group. And got a lot more material here than thanks Jenny P, and I got a free ticket too, so I guess I best go. I think the 14th is actually a busy day of the week, that is. But that's a free screening at the Virginia Theater. There are often free screenings of documentaries on Mondays at the Art Theater. I haven't actually been to one in a while. 359-9338. Do support independent media. It's important for us to hear from you. It helps me get an attaboy every now and again. Almost A Quintet is playing opposite the 12th Annual Jazz Walk, which was rained out yesterday, and who knows, maybe they have a third rain date, and it'll be on tomorrow, so I can go to that instead of Almost A Quintet at the Iron Post. Desafinado's got a free gig at 2 in the afternoon at the Champaign Public Library. Not a nightclub setting or an outdoor event, but you can chase the music there if you want to. All right, what did I announce would be next? If I did, I'll default to another pitch. The number down here is 359-9338. Thanks to all the regular donors I've had through the years, if your time is up. I also want to highlight payroll deduction. If you work for one of the bigger institutions in town, state institutions, larger corporations, actually some of them have matching donations. If you make a charitable donation, they'll match it or even double it. We've actually gotten some money from ADM out in Decatur in the past with their matching corporate money. We'll take it. But local charities, charitable giving through your, say, U of I job, since a lot of people are in that category, you can do payroll deduction and just ask your workmates. There should be somebody in your work unit that helps you do that kind of thing. And it's not that terribly hard. You can go to WEF.org and just make a donation online anonymously, or you can call down here and give some feedback if you like as well. Election Protection, yes. Greg Palast's film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. It's been a regular feature. I'll get to that right now since we're at the half hour and barely have enough time. Well, we'll see if we can get a little bit of Gareth Porter on. And this is Kevin Pena interviewing, chatting with Greg Palast the day before the film screening. Or is it that very night? Last night in Oakland, the original screening. It's actually been screened in St. Louis at the Netflix gathering, and they were trying to get that a free screening. I thought about going down there, and people might have seen it in Philadelphia in the park. Somebody sprang for some big Jumbotron video displays, and one of the things that was screened on it was the Best Democracy Money Can Buy. A great place to view it, I'm sure. Anyway, here's from Flashpoints. You can find it at Flashpoints News Magazine on SoundCloud, where you can find some WEFTA material as well. You look for it. It's an interesting way to podcast, as it were. Haven't had a call through the first half hour. Really would appreciate one. 359-9338.
Stand off at Standing Rock.
Let's select the right one here.
The Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, if you've been tuned into this show over the last month or so, you probably heard the regular series between Greg Palast, who is the author of the book The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and our executive producer, Dennis Bernstein, called The Election Crimes Bulletin. Well, Greg's new film of the same name, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, is going to be premiering tomorrow night here in Oakland, California at the Grand Lake Theater. I wanted to bring Greg on. He's on the road on his way from Los Angeles here into town for tomorrow night's screening. Greg, welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
I'm thrilled to be with you. And while San Francisco will get the first bite, we'll be having openings New York, L.A., you name it. And in fact, we have a system set up where people can, in fact, say, I want it in my city, and it will go to your city at no cost. But as long as someone says, I want to be there, just go to gregpalast.com. We're very unusual. Why are we doing this? Because my foundation is making sure that we're going to bust open how they're going to steal 2016. It'd be a good idea to find out before they actually do it. And so, but the other thing is, if you want to get a taste of the investigation, because this is really, it's the Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which was, of course, the big number one bestseller across the country. It's a book. It's completely updated. It's not just a book. What we've done is, you're following me. This is a real live detective story. And you're going to follow me on my investigation for Rolling Stone, uncovering how they're going to rip off the 2016 election. And we also have, I have a lot of help on this investigation. It's technically a documentary, but we call it a nonfiction movie because I have helping me on the investigation, Ice-T and Detective Munch, Richard Belzer from CSU, SVU. Whatever, Law and Order, SVU. Sorry, I don't watch TV.
CSI, SV, one of those. SUV?
No. SVU. And anyway, they come out of the TV screen when I'm stumped and help me out. We also have Rosario Dawson trying to fool me in thinking that she's another illegal Hispanic voter.
I also saw Willie Nelson in there making a cameo.
Willie Nelson is in there as well, he plays unusually, it's a stretch, but he's playing a kind of stoner itinerant musician. He is on a list of people voting twice, and I kid you not, he's really on this Republican hit list of people voting twice, and so they're going to lose their right to vote. And he's accused of voting a second time as Willie Mae Nelson, a woman.
Unbelievable. So
he kept laughing. I'm trying to film this thing and he keeps laughing.
How could you deny Willie Nelson the right to vote? I mean, that's amazing.
Well, I did ask him if he was, because he kept couldn't stop giggling. I said, are you high on something? Are you smoking something? He said, so it was quite funny. So he thought my the weird list calling him a female having voted a second time, Mississippi is Willie Mae. But anyway, that's part of the film. So the film is deeply serious, but it's also deeply funny. And we have so this will be nationwide. Please go to gregpalace.com. You can read the Rolling Stone investigation there. But if you really want to get a flavor for it and you get to meet, you know, I'm just the nose on camera, but we have behind me, in fact, at the wheel right now, is our chief investigatrix, Ms. Badpenny, Lenny Badpenny, really her name. And we also, you get to meet some, then you get to confront some of the dripping officials who are scrubbing the voter rolls of anything that suggests Black, Hispanic, or Asian American.
You're being tongue-in-cheek here, and you're using a lot of it. You're presenting as if it's a lot of shtick, right? That's a put-up in the film. But in fact, it's about a real issue, you know, based on Rolling Stone article, that article that you wrote for Rolling Stone. That's an expose of how the Republicans are trying to steal the next elections.
Yeah, well, actually, they're doing a pretty good job. And what I'm really concerned with right now, honestly, is that, you know, Trump may be roadkill. But the guys behind him are really concerned about the U.S. Senate. And this stuff is going on in Ohio and North Carolina, Arizona, where the control of the U.S. Senate is going to be determined.
Critical.
And believe me. And also, you know, while there's a lot of fun in the film, and because it is damn entertaining, but the thing is, it's also, you're going to get the real no-poop investigative information. Plus, I do something that's just not done. Not only do I go after the, you know, they use the term vote suppression. You know, someone steals your car, they're not suppressing your car, they're stealing it. So I don't use suppression. But beyond the vote theft, who's behind it? And we keep saying like you said, Republicans, that's the normal. Yes, they are the kind of conduits, they're the carriers of this anti-democratic virus. But the real problem are the billionaires behind it. So the subtitle of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy is A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. And by the way, there's a book coming out of the same with the film, the same investigation, the updated stuff. But it's about billionaires. And what we do is we go after the guys, including, for example, the billionaire behind Donald Trump. And, you know, people don't think about this. Donald Trump plays a billionaire on television.
Well, and billionaires by definition are bipartisan.
Yes, they buy with both hands. Well, no. That's be fair. They bought the Republican Party, but they have to rent it. And you know, let's be honest. So what happens? You get the, you know, besides there's the Trump who plays a billionaire on TV, but the real billionaire behind him is a guy known as JP, the foreclosure king, and we hunt him down, down and say, because these guys. As one of the points, in fact, Salon just wrote a big raving review. I shouldn't say raving. It makes that guy sound like he's nuts. A positive review of the film, quoting my statement that there's no such thing as a victimless billionaire. This guy, JP, who's behind Trump, the silent billionaire behind Trump, made $5 billion in a year. And he didn't make it because he's not Oprah. He didn't, you know, make his money by showing us our human frailty. He didn't make it by the way Oprah did, made her money by showing us our human failings. He made his money by taking advantage of human failing. He's the guy that kicked the mortgage market over a cliff and pulled in $5 billion personally. In 2008.
Well, it's got to be one of the stars of the movie for sure. But we're out of time. Again, that is Greg Palace. Will Durst is going to be there, right? Also, we're going to have comedian Will Durst. And again, the film is The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits by Greg Palace. Again, tomorrow night at the Grand Lake.
Okay. And I was going to the Greg Palace site to find out where the screenings are. He mentioned that it actually played first in San Francisco, or was it L.A.? Tim Robbins, one of the few real leftists in Hollywood, actually, is involved in the film in some way, too. I don't know if he's production, road running, or story ideas, or maybe he has a cameo, too, and they left him out. But John P. is John Paulson, not to be confused with the former Secretary of Treasury. I'm sure he'd love to have that position. Maybe that's what he's lobbying for. We have Paul Singer, the Vulture Fund hedge fund guy, backing the Republicans. And, I think he might have split off, and he's going after only local campaigns, like they're saying, the down ballots. Okay, 20 minutes after, I kind of threw that bit about Hollywood liberals and radicals, because there's also this idea of political correctness that Trump is making a lot of hay out of, and it's also not true that the Academy is full of wild-eyed radicals. There are some liberals, there are some leftists here and there, but the predominant control is very staid. And this is illustrated in the great books by John K. Wilson, and he conveyed a bit of it to the audience at the Friday Forum. The inaugural Friday Forum is going to be rebroadcast on Monday. Check your local listings or keep your ears up for a possible change in that schedule. I'm not sure if that's going to happen or not. But wanted to play a little excerpt of the talk that will be aired in its entirety. It will also be available through UPTV on a regular TV screen, and there should be an archive of the live streaming event. Now you can go to the University YMCA website or Facebook page and find a link to that. I posted it on a posting that I made during the event and yesterday. So you can find it, and it's worth your attention. It's pretty radical stuff in a way, because it sort of subverts the whole premise of political correctness and sees it as a tool to suppress speech as from the right, as opposed to any kind of broad. He gives an example, which I don't play here, about the vagina monologues being canceled somewhere and some liberal making a big deal out of it because it wasn't radical enough. But they actually did do another play in its stead, and they set a 20-year-old play. And another theater group in the area took over the annual doing of the vagina monologues. I don't remember where this was, but it's an interesting way that things get characterized as political correctness when, if you look in a little closer, like John K. Wilson does. So this is just a short 10-minute excerpt. I'll probably do some pitching after, and then we'll hear a little bit of Gareth Porter interviewed on this Redacted Tonight show, which may be on RT, but I think it actually circulates on its own as well. Maybe they picked it up. We have to watch out for that Russian propaganda. But then when people like Palast and others are only available on media, it kind of makes you wonder, as it always does, the corporate press. Something else, the TPP was a big issue this week because of the meeting in China. And finally, somebody's doing something about the investor dispute resolution system or something, which is basically allowing corporate lawyers to decide what's in the interest of their corporations and not in the interest of the governments that have signed away a lot of their sovereignty. But obviously, the corporate press doesn't want to emphasize that. That's a thing to highlight, I think, because it is still going to be attempted to be passed in a lame duck session, apparently. At least that's what POTUS says. All right, here's an excerpt from the Friday Forum. Again, there are different ways of hearing it, but reliably be on next Monday. The series is about all of the issues that are in the election, and there's a special Friday Forum on the Tuesday election day as well. Maybe I'll run down. Robert McChesney's got a major talk in the series too, so I'm looking forward to that as well. One of the ones that I know about. The number down here is 359-9338. Really like to hear from you. Take some time out of your Saturday morning and call in or go to the weft.org site and pledge some money to Weft. Thanks for listening, and in any event,
because of political correctness or conservative correctness, it is quite real on a case-by-case basis. But the fact is that political correctness doesn't describe what's really happening. Left-wingers don't have hegemonic control of college campuses. And of course, being here at the University of Illinois, I can only mention the name Stephen Salaita as a very real case of how there aren't right-wing professors getting fired for their offensive tweets. It's a left-wing professor. And it's that conservative correctness, that power to repress, that's very common on college campuses across the country. And it's notable, of course, that Jonathan Chait and the others who tell these stories about the political correctness movements, they don't mention a word about cases like Stephen Salaita. They're too busy complaining about people who talk about microaggressions or who want voluntary trigger warnings or safe spaces to worry about somebody who merely gets fired from their job for their political opinions. And that, to me, is kind of the hypocrisy of the left and the hypocrisy of this kind of war on political correctness. And political correctness and attacking political correctness has been a very successful strategy and a very successful marketing tool, even. There's now one company out there that promotes, quote, politically incorrect products for the firearm industry. So if you want a paper target to shoot Bernie Sanders, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, or the Prophet Muhammad, who comes with an optional crotch shot to target, you can buy these, depending on how much you hate Muslims or crotches or whatever. And so this is the kind of commerce of political incorrectness. And so we wouldn't be surprised, I don't think, that Donald Trump has seized upon political incorrectness as one of his core tools for marketing himself. And Trump has declared, quote, "I think the big problem this country has is being politically correct." And to me, that many people might think that we have a big problem with crime or the economy or stopping terrorism, but being politically correct to Trump is one of these core issues. And Trump turns his political incorrectness really into a tool for excusing all of his outrageous and stupid remarks. That when he insults someone, when he says something that's incredibly bigoted, for many of his supporters, it's not something that makes them think he shouldn't be elected president because he's just being politically incorrect. He's showing that he's a warrior against the establishment, that he's fighting against these people who want to suppress politically incorrect speech. And so the fact that he says something, even if it offends them personally, it doesn't matter because it's the fact that he's being offensive that's one of his primary tools, one of his primary appeals to the public. And as a former KKK leader, David Duke, wrote about Trump, quote, "I think he deserves a closer look by those of us who believe the era of political correctness needs to come to an end." So for Trump's white supremacist base, he is the warrior against political correctness. And in many ways, the attacks on political correctness are especially appealing to the straight white male conservative. Because really, PC is what has enabled the straight white male conservative to take upon themselves the mantle of victimhood. All of these people claiming to be oppressed, women, minorities, the poor, they're not really oppressed. It's us white guys who are the victims of oppression from the PC police. And Donald Trump is the embodiment of all of that. Whether he's attacking putting Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill as pure political correctness, or any of his other kinds of attacks. For example, Trump says about his foreign policy in fighting ISIS, quote, "We're fighting a very politically correct war," unquote, because we're not torturing terrorists and murdering their families. He says things like, "Saddam Hussein killed terrorists. He didn't do it politically correct." And for Trump, invoking political correctness is this way for him to portray the other side as weak and wrong without bothering to make an argument. Trump never needs to explain why murdering innocent people is a good foreign policy. He simply needs to denounce his opponents as politically correct. And comedian Bill Maher warned that Donald Trump's popularity was a result of, quote, "the backlash to political correctness." And he argued, quote, "None of that justifies embracing a dangerous buffoon simply because his lack of political correctness is cathartic." And many others have pointed to Trump's political incorrectness as the reason to appeal and as a reason for them to vote for him, in essence, that he's fighting against this social dogma. And in a recent interview in Esquire, Clint Eastwood said about Trump, quote, "He's on to something because secretly everybody's getting tired of political correctness, kissing up. That's the kiss-ass generation we're in right now. We're really in a pussy generation. Everybody's walking on eggshells. We see people accused of being racist and all kinds of stuff. When I grew up, those things weren't called racist," end quote. So when Clint Eastwood grew up, racist things weren't called racist, and white men really seemed to like it that way. And Eastwood added, quote, "You know, he's a racist now because he talked about this judge. And yeah, it's a dumb thing to say. I mean, to predicate your opinion on the fact that the guy was born to Mexican parents or something, he said a lot of dumb things. So have all of them, both sides. But everybody, the press and everybody's going, oh, well, that's racist. And they're making a big hoodoo out of it. Just f***ing get over it. It's a sad time in history." End quote. And yes, I guess it is a sad time in history when you can't attack someone for having Mexican parents without being called racist. And that is the essence of this. And it's notable how widespread that attack was. House Speaker Paul Ryan called Trump's comments on Judge Gonzalo Curiel, quote, "the textbook definition of a racist comment," end quote. Which in fact it is, but Clint Eastwood seems to think that the textbook definition of a racist comment shouldn't be called racist. And I thought, well, maybe I've got Mr. Eastwood sitting here in this chair, and I could ask him a couple questions. And yes, Mr. Eastwood, I know you've got a new movie out today to promote. Spoiler alert, Sully lands the plane. But when I say that Donald Trump is a racist, and Mr. Eastwood here calls me the P word because talking about bigotry makes you so gutless and cowardly you need to be compared to a woman, if it's wrong to call anyone a racist, why isn't it wrong to use the P word as well to criticize someone? What do you mean, shut up? I am not going to shut up. It's my turn. Well, Mr. Eastwood, you don't seem to want to answer these questions. You know, Mr. Eastwood, Trump called Hillary a bigot and claimed, quote, "her policies are bigoted because she knows they're not going to work." So isn't Donald Trump being politically correct by calling Hillary Clinton a racist, Mr. Eastwood? I'm sorry, Mr. Eastwood, I can't do that to myself either. I think we're learning here that talking to empty chairs is not a particularly good rhetorical technique. Perhaps we'll leave Mr. Eastwood to his press promotion jacket and move on and talk some more about Donald Trump. And I think there's an important difference between Donald Trump just labeling someone a bigot because he thinks their policies won't help black people and his will, and what I define by racism. I don't think Donald Trump is a racist because of his pro-rich policies that won't help the majority of black people. I don't think all conservatives are racist, or all Republicans are racist, or having a belief in a certain public policy, such as affirmative action, makes you a racist. When I call Donald Trump a racist, and I do frequently in my book, it's because there is evidence that he is racist, that he calls Mexicans rapists, that he says laziness is a trait of blacks, that he ran his family company when there's overwhelming evidence of racial discrimination, that he lied about and continues to lie about, that he's a birther and a leader of the birther movement. All of these things, and many more that I write about, are the evidence that he's a racist. And so I don't think that we should just randomly go around throwing the term racist. I think we should use it very carefully when people actually deserve it. And certainly Donald Trump is somebody who deserves it. And I think this whole...
Well, not the most artful edit. That can be heard in its entirety. Well, you can go to it and look for it at the University YMCA. There's a live stream that has about the same audio fidelity. That's John K. Wilson, an independent scholar, I believe, is still his status in Bloomington. He's got about 10 books out, and the latest one about Trump is called Trump Unveiled, Exposing the Bigoted Billionaire. And it's OR Press imprint, London and New York, it says here. Well, I only have a few minutes left. I don't think I'm going to put on the Gareth Porter in that short time. I would have another inartful edit. So I'm just going to mention again the series that the John K. Wilson Friday Forum comes from on the issues analyzing the 2016 elections all the way to Election Day, and then a hiatus. Next week is Politics of Climate Change in Illinois, Jennifer Walling. No affiliation right here on gun violence prevention. Remember, again, there's a film by Moms for Action, Sensible Action on gun regulation. I'm all freelancing that since I just posted that poster up. Campaign Finance and Citizens United, Trevor Gervais, What Went Wrong and How Do We Fix It? Immigration issue, well, that's a big one, Alexander Philandra. And then I mentioned Robert McChesney on October 14th, Friday. We broadcast it generally the Monday following, though that might be subject to change. Last election of the 20th century or the first election of the 21st. Pivotal change maybe or not. The Divided States of America about political polarization. I guess I should go argue with that one. Not enough polarization on major issues. The battle over the ballot. Voting rights. Maybe we can coordinate by the 10th, the 28th of October, a screening of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Abe Scar, since he's got a lot to illuminate, cross-check. There's a new petition up at Greg Palast's website about releasing the cross-check information. This ruse for disqualifying voters. And then Justice Scalia's death and what the 2016 campaign means for the Supreme Court, Colleen Connell. Betcha she's a lawyer. And then, as I mentioned, there's a special Friday forum, quote-unquote, on Election Day on a Tuesday forum with the What's Next for the U.S. question mark. That'll be at noon, so probably we won't really know too much about what's next at that point. And so the screening of Under the Gun is the 14th of September at the Virginia, and it's free. You can get a free ticket, or you can just show up. Probably won't be overflowing. In the last few seconds, I generally don't do this during a pledge drive, but what the heck. I'll try and get to some Gareth Porter. Find him on Facebook. Maybe we'll just hear a little sample of Almost A. And they're holding for tonight. There's a jazz walk, weather permitting. It was postponed from yesterday out at Meadowbrook Park, which could be quite big fun, it seems. But support live local music. There's been some great stuff. The party last night at Krannert was absolutely fabulous. To pick a random pair of descriptors. But okay, I should reprise the gathering to bring the issue of Saudi repression internally and externally. Arms sales, weapons for repression. The U.S. is big time selling stuff to the Saudis, and Durban can be somewhat pivotal, it seems to me, in this battle. Cluster bombs still being sold, apparently. The next screenings of the film Greg Palast's Best Democracy Money Can Buy. The next one I see on his calendar is in Madison, Wisconsin. So if you have some friends up that way, at the Barrymore Theater on Thursday, September 15th. So, and then Sarasota, Florida. Hopefully coming to a screen near us for the election. and go to his website about this petition to pull the veil away from the cross-check program.